Welcome back to the Sea Stories and Science Fiction Podcast. Today we have part two of a story called Rufus Armstrong, Practical Jokes. So if you haven't listened to part one, click back over to the podcast and listen to part one of Rufus Armstrong, Practical Jokes. Well, welcome aboard, shipmates. It's great to have you back here at the Sea Stories and Science Fiction Podcast. And in this episode, we have the conclusion of the story Rufus Armstrong, Practical Jokes. We'll find out what kind of gags and funny situations Rufus gets himself into here. So we'll pick up where we left off after part one. And I have a quick shout out for you for a book that I recently read that I thought was just outstanding. And I want to do a little recommendation for this. The book I'm talking about is called The Story of a Shipwrecked Sailor, and it's written by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Now, this is an interesting book because it's a true story, and it was published as a series of newspaper articles, but now collected into a little paperback. It's just 100 pages, so it's a quick read, but it's very well written. You may know that Gabriel Garcia Marquez wrote several world-renowned bestsellers, 100 Years of Solitude and The General in His Labyrinth, Chronicle of a Death Foretold, and Love in the Time of Cholera. So all of these literary masterpieces by the Nobel Prize-winning Gabriel Garcia Marquez, if you've read some of those. But here we have a very interesting the way this book came together. I'll just read the little blurb off the jacket here for you. This is a true story. In 1955, Gabriel Garcia Marquez was working for El Espectador, a newspaper in Bogota, Colombia. In February of that year, eight crew members of the Caldas, a Colombian destroyer, were washed overboard and disappeared. 10 days later, one of them turned up, barely alive, on a deserted beach in northern Colombia. This book, which originally appeared as a series of newspaper articles, is Garcia Marquez's account of that sailor's ordeal. Written early in his career, The Story of a Shipwrecked Sailor displays all the dramatic flair and narrative urgency of the stories and novels that have established Gabriel Marquez's later reputation. So I, being a book nerd, I have read several great books by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. If you've never read anything by him, I recommend you read a book called 100 Years of Solitude. It uses magical realism, and it's just a fantastic book. So now you have this great writer, and then he's got this book, The Story of a Shipwrecked Sailor. It says here, the story of a shipwrecked sailor who drifted on a life raft for 10 days without food or water, was proclaimed a national hero, kissed by beauty queens, made rich through publicity, and then spurned by the government and forgotten for all time. And it's a true story, and it's kind of cool because the destroyer that they're on is actually in Mobile, Alabama. It's there for repairs. And the Colombian sailors are out in town, and they've got girlfriends in town, and they're hanging out and having fun. And so that's kind of neat to read about that. And then they leave, the ship leaves Mobile, and they're headed south across the Gulf of Mexico and down into the Caribbean Sea, past the Yucatan Peninsula and Honduras and Nicaragua, and they're heading down to Colombia, and these sailors get washed overboard. And then the story is kind of like what happened then, and then it follows up afterwards with the after story of this one survivor. So just a really nice story, and like I said, it's only 100 pages, so easy to read. Just a little gem that I scoured the bookstores and the bookshelves and the websites looking for sea stories, and you rarely see this one, and I'm surprised because it's really good. So grab a copy of that and put it on your to-be-read list, The Story of a Shipwrecked Sailor by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And now we're going to get into today's story, which is Rufus Armstrong, Practical Jokes. Let's just recap a little bit about part one. You'll recall Mr. Armstrong was a sailor aboard several different ships in the first half of the story, and Rufus liked to play practical jokes on people. He filled one guy's hat with water, and he ended up dumping it over his head. And another guy, he stole his pot of tea and filled it with salt water, and he drank the water and coughed and gagged. Another guy he was carrying to shore, this guy had a really nice outfit on, and he ended up stumbling and falling on him and getting him soaking wet. And there was a sailor who was on watch, and he was taking a nap. So Rufus went over and very delicately tied a rope around the man's neck and then called off an alarm of sorts, and the captain ran out, and this guy got up and had a rope wrapped around his neck, and he was yelling and screaming and got himself in trouble for that. And you'll recall the story ended with a melee in Batavia. There was a big street fight going on, and Rufus snuck up behind a Chinaman who had a long braid of hair down his back. And Rufus took out his sharp knife and snipped off the man's braid and ran away with it. And the man and his contingent ran after Rufus and the other sailors, but they got away. So Rufus made it back to Boston, and he's got this man's braid with him. So we'll pick up the story where we left off. Before we get into it, though, let's have a quick word from our sponsor. So today's story, Rufus Armstrong, Practical Jokes. Rufus Armstrong got safe home to Boston with his prize, and when he was paid off, he procured a stylish scratch with love locks of an auburn color, and got the unfortunate Chinaman's braid neatly spliced to the after part of it, and he took great delight in walking about with his dandy locks, and his braid decked with ribbons, reaching to his heels, an object of curiosity, admiration, or envy to all he met. It was election day. The common was covered with booths, where liquors of every variety were paraded in decanters or glasses, to catch the eye of the moderate drinker or the habitual drunkard, and scenes of wild disorder, language of a most offensive character, and quarreling and fighting, the inevitable consequences of a free indulgence in intoxicating drinks, were frequent on the common, notwithstanding old Reed, with a score of constables, was stationed on that part of the common where the booths stood the thickest, ready to make war upon and capture all offenders against the peace of the good old town of Boston. Rufus, with a couple of his shipmates, called at one of those respectable places and took some refreshments, which in those days was the technical term for alcoholic drink. They handed the owner of the booth a $5 bill and demanded the change. In those days, all dram sellers were not strictly conscientious men, anxious for the public good, as it is said to be the case at the present time, but were apt to take advantage of a sailor or drunkard which opportunity might offer. And the man who supplied Rufus and his shipmates with liquor, I regret to say, was a person of this description. He very naturally thought that if sailors would foolishly squander away their money, he had as good a right to share of it as any other person. Acting upon this principle, he returned our hero among his change a $3 bill of uncurrent money. Rufus and his friends remained in the common, cracking their jokes and gazing upon the strange sights, and treating little children with election buns and gingerbread, and it was not long before it became necessary to break the $3 bill. It was accordingly tendered to the keeper of a booth, in payment for sundry fancy articles, who declared that the bill, as far from being worth $3, was not worth a mill. This was a damper. However, they were fortunately able to muster enough money to pay the man, and then they started full chisel after the dram seller who had treated them so unhandsomely. After a fatiguing search for nearly an hour, they found him, but he did not seem particularly pleased with their appearance again in his scene. He did not even smile upon them as they approached, as is customary with the dram sellers of the present day. But a scowl rested on his brow, and when Rufus accused him of dishonesty in endeavoring to palm upon them a worthless piece of paper and demanded restitution, the fellow, with the most unblushing effrontery, denied the charge and ordered them away, thus adding insult to injury, which they could not brook. High words ensued. People were attracted to the spot. Some incipient symptoms of a riot appeared, and the man, alarmed for his property and his person, insolently told them to be civil and clear out at once, or he would give them in charge of a constable who would deposit them in jail. At the same time, seeing old Reed, of captivating memory, approaching the booth in a very calm, philosophical manner, he shouted aloud for assistance. The sailors, finding that in addition to being swindled out of their money and insulted, they were likely to be imprisoned, did not continue to cherish a violent affection for their accommodating friend, who had so neatly relieved them of their surplus funds, and argued very foolishly, as sailors are too apt to argue, that if they must go to jail, they would not go to jail for nothing. Acting upon this dangerous principle, one of them, without further ado, gave the dishonest trafficker a gentle tap beneath the ear, which laid him sprawling on the green sward, and at the same time, Rufus and the other shipmates seized the long table and tipped it over on the astonished liquor seller, and dire was the confusion and destruction of glasses, tumblers, crockery, and decanters, with their precious contents which ensued. The soil got intoxicated with that liquor, which it was intended should degrade and madden human beings. Rufus and his shipmates sprang from the booth and attempted to make their escape, but old Reed was at their heels and singled out Rufus, who was making the whole common ring with his contagious laugh, as his especial prey. The bystanders did not seem inclined to interfere, but cheered Rufus, with his interminable long braid gorgeously decked with red ribbons as he whisked past, like a comet with a fiery tail. But he had one on his heels, who had his land tax on board, and who was seldom vanquished in a foot race. Rufus jumped over the wooden fence which lined the mall with the agility of a cat, and exercised his drumsticks very handsomely. But the long-limbed constable gained rapidly upon him, and before the chase reached West Street, Reed was so close to his heels that he reached out his hand to grasp the braid. One spring more, and he was in near enough. He seized it. He clutched it within his hand and smiled grimly, expecting to bring up the offender all standing, and the spectators and the chase thought it was all up with Rufus, and looked melancholy and disappointed that he had not escaped. Old Reed relaxed his pace and gave a sudden jerk, but his disappointment and mortification may be conceived when, instead of a daring offender, he found nothing in his possession but a superb braid with a scratch well garnished with love locks dangling at the end of it. But old Reed was not a man easily discouraged, or one who was apt to lose his presence of mind on such occasions. He dropped the braid as if it had been a cobra capello or a hot potato, and prosecuted the race with renewed vigor. Rufus had by this time gained on his pursuer several paces, but he soon heard old Reed again panting in his wake. He half turned his head to watch the motions of the officer, and just as the constable, with a savage grin on his countenance, was felicitating himself on the prospect of seizing Blue Jacket and putting him in limbo, Rufus dropped on all fours as suddenly as if he had been shot, and poor Reed, who was going at the time at least 13 knots an hour, struck him with such violence that the shock sent him pitch-poling 2 or 3 rods ahead when he fell prostrate on the pavement. But Rufus, up like a lamplighter, as soon as the crisis was past and while old Reed was gathering himself up, dashed down Mason Street and turned into a backyard where he concealed himself until the coast was clear. His scratch and his appendage were picked up by a brother tar and afterwards restored to him safe and sound. The last time that Rufus Armstrong went to sea was in the fine ship Mandricardo of Boston. He was second mate of that ship and proved himself an active, trustworthy, and ever vigilant officer. When he was before the mast, he loved to steal a nap on deck before his watch, especially when it was not his lookout, and many a sweet sleep has he enjoyed seated in the body of the windlass, well wrapped in his monkey jacket, and his head reposing on the bits. But when he was promoted, he seemed to be aware of the responsibility which rested upon him, and never allowed himself to be caught napping. He constantly walked the quarter-deck, watching the wind and the weather, and kept the sails constantly trimmed according to the breeze. He would also cause a good lookout to be kept on the forecastle, and rigorously extracted from the starboard watch, that one man, at least, should at all times be awake and moving. It was a cold but clear moonlit night in the month of November, as the ship Mandricardo was dashing along with the wind abeam on soundings off the entrance to the British Channel. The starboard watch had the first watch that night, and Mr. Armstrong gave the men strict orders to keep a good lookout ahead. But about 7 bells, much to his surprise and indignation, he became aware that no one was walking the forecastle deck. Old Peter Peterson, a Swede, a veteran seaman who, by the way, was hardly ever seen asleep in his life, was leaning over the gunwale in the lee waist, quietly smoking a cheroot. Rufus asked him whose lookout it was. "Jonathan Doolittle's," replied Peter. "Why, the fellow is fast asleep somewhere. The good-for-nothing vagabond cannot be trusted. He would sleep with his head in a bucket of water, but I will try to awaken him at any rate." Mr. Armstrong walked forward softly and beheld on the inner part of the bowsprit the gaunt form of Jonathan Doolittle, stretched at full length, his head lying between the knightheads, his capacious mouth wide open and snoring away as if for a wager. Rufus told Peter to keep silent and draw a bucket of water. He then went aft and told the man at the wheel not to be alarmed at any noise which he might hear, and to pay no attention to any orders he might give from the forecastle to alter the course. The helmsman grinned intelligence, for he knew Mr. Armstrong well. Rufus then went forward again. Poor Jonathan was still in the same position, transported to the land of dreams and apparently deeply engaged in bottling off sleep, as if to secure a stock for a long voyage. The second mate took the bucket of salt water, stood over Jonathan, and gently poured a portion of the contents into his capacious mouth. This was an awkward interruption to Jonathan's deep reveries. The poor fellow was almost suffocated. And while he was gasping and struggling to get breath, Rufus rolled him on deck and dashed the remainder of the water in his face, at the same time screaming in a loud voice, "Hard down your helm! Jonathan's overboard!" This was all enacted in less time than it can be described, and the whole thing was so admirably managed that poor Doolittle actually believed he had fallen overboard while asleep on the bowsprit, and being a good swimmer, he struck out on the deck as if for dear life and looked like an overgrown frog trying to swim in a basin of water. He essayed to call for help, but the salt water in his throat prevented, and the coughing and sputtering and struggling of the poor fellow were such that neither the second officer nor Peter Peterson could restrain from their risible muscles, but burst out into laugh, which rang merrily through the ship and was the means of bringing Jonathan to his senses, though not before the watch below, as well as the remainder of the watch on deck, roused by the dreadful cry of a man overboard, had rushed to the scene of action in time to enjoy the joke. Jonathan Doolittle was cursed of sleeping on deck, and was ever afterwards vigilant when entrusted with a lookout. But Rufus was not always lucky enough to get away with a whole skin. Practical jokers are ever looked upon with suspicion, and regarded as dangerous, even though diverting members of society, and, not unfrequently, are compelled to pay a heavy penalty for cracking their jokes. Rufus was once on a visit to an uncle of his, a farmer who resided in the state of Maine. He passed some happy days romping with his pretty cousins and joking with the lively, good-humored girls who abounded in the neighborhood. One afternoon, a number of these flowers of the human species met at his uncle's house, and after some mysterious consultation, retired to an unfurnished and gloomy room in the back part of the building, apparently with a view of carrying out some wise plan which their noodles had conceived. But they could not altogether conceal their designs from Rufus, and from some conversations which he had with them a few days previous, as well as from the excited and wild looks and flashing eyes as his fair cousins, whenever they left the scene of action for a few minutes, in order to procure some kitchen utensils, or for other equally important purposes, he was convinced that the girls were trying projects, or, in other words, were seeking to penetrate the mysteries of futurity and learn, by certain mystical proceedings, charms, conjurations, etc., whether they should ever be so fortunate as to be married, and if so, the names, characters, and persons of their husbands. This is one of the relics of superstition imported into our country from our fatherland. It is still cherished in some of the interior villages in New England, but it is gradually becoming extinct under the all-pervading influence of general intelligence. An opportunity was thus presented to Rufus of playing off upon the girls a practical joke, and without anticipating any serious consequences to either the girls or himself, he forthwith proceeded to put in execution his mischievous plans. He had noticed a few days before the hide of a black ox hanging over a beam in the barn. The animal had been slaughtered only a week or two, and of course was not divested of hair, horns, or tail. Rufus arrayed himself in this as an outer garment, in lieu of a waterproof pea jacket, and arranged that portion of the hide which had covered the cranium of the ox, when that unfortunate animal was living, in such a manner as to conceal the greater part of his visage, and display his horns to the best advantage. He triced up the tail to produce a picturesque effect, and confined the hide to his waist, with a large ox chain, with which he took a turn round the body, and passed the ends over his shoulders, where they remained dangling, looking very prettily. Thus whimsically accoutred, and determined on sport, Rufus proceeded to the house, and entered by the back door. He moved stealthily along towards the room on the lower floor, which the girls had selected for their theater of their mysterious incantations and charms. He listened at the door, but all was quiet, for the girls at that moment were awaiting in silence, but with fear and trembling, the result of a terribly interesting experiment. Rufus gave three stamps on the threshold. The girls turned pale and looked at each other inquiringly. "What can that be?" said timid Elmira Hunt, gathering herself into as small a compass as possible, as if she would like to stow herself away in a nutshell. "Jane," whispered another, "I guess you had better open the door." "Stamp, stamp, stamp," was repeated, but with more violence than before. "For pity's sake, Jane, do open the door," entreated one of the frightened girls in a low and tremulous voice. Jane, thus conjured, reluctantly approached the door and drew back the bolt, to ascertain the character and object of this intruder upon their mystic ceremonies, ceremonies which should never be witnessed by the eyes of man. The door opened with a creaking noise. Jane gave a piercing scream and retreated as rapidly as if she had been shot out of a railway car, hurled over an embankment, overturned two of her companions, and Rufus Armstrong, in full costume, shaking his huge ox chain and flourishing his tail, stalked into the room, bellowing in a loud and hoarse voice, "Hello, ho, 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 what do you want of me?" The consternation which was produced among this interesting bevy of girls by the horrible apparition which stood in the midst of them may be conceived but cannot be described. Elmira Hunt gave one scream and fainted on the spot, and Lavinia Stevens followed her example. Isabella Davis, calling for help in her loudest key, rushed to the window and turned a somersault out of it, which would have commanded the admiration or excited the envy of the most accomplished tumbler at a circus. And Sarah Hopkins followed her example, while Jane Baxter, Rufus's favorite cousin, with two of her companions, made a bold rush past the specter for the door, shouting and screaming like the whistle of a steam engine, only, of course, in a more mellifluous tone. Mary Martin crouched into the further corner of the room, not daring to move and hardly daring to breathe, while Adeline Somers concealed herself snugly beneath the table. Rufus, all the while, continued his hideous noise, stamping and shaking his chain, and wagging his head in order to set off his horns to advantage. It happened, unfortunately for Rufus, that Jonathan Baxter, who had been at work in the field digging potatoes, was then approaching the house. He was a tall, wiry-built Yankee, and, like many other Yankees, in a good cause, was not afraid of facing any being alive or dead, or in whatever shape it might appear. He had heard the screams of the girls, and in a moment after saw his sister rushing towards him, as if pursued by a panther, with wildness in her eyes and terror in her countenance. Jonathan was astonished. "What's the matter, Jane?" he said. But Jane was too far gone to speak coherently. She could only point to the house and gasp out, "Oh, Jonathan, do save them!" This was enough. Jonathan left Jane lying panting and trembling in the path, and with leaps of surprising longitude, made his way towards the house. As he passed the door, he seized a hickory axe handle, which was quietly reposing there, unconscious of the work it was destined to perform. He entered the parlor, where he found no one but Arabelle Tompkins lying in the middle of the floor and screaming as if for dear life. As soon as she saw Jonathan, she pointed to the inner door and said, "There, there!" Jonathan caught a glimpse of the specter through the door, astonished but not daunted at the sight. He grasped his club with a firmer grip, brandished it over his head, and sprang forward. Rufus Armstrong was chuckling with delight at the success of his joke, and was beginning to think he had carried it far enough, and that it was time to disencumber himself of his disguise, when the axe handle alighted upon his head with a force as if wielded by a giant's arm. The first blow knocked off the horns and laid bare his head. The second descended with terrific force upon the loftiest pinnacle of his cranium. Rufus fell senseless to the floor, and the huge chain rattled ominously as he fell. Jonathan, however, had no intention to discontinue the assault. He sprang with his whole weight upon the prostrate specter, dropped his weapon, and grappled him fiercely by the throat. Then, and not till then, he noted the features of the fiend, and was indeed astonished to find that they were those of a comely young man, those of his cousin and friend, Rufus Armstrong. "Why, is this you, Rufus? Who'd have thought it? What trick are you playing now, I should like to know?" asked Jonathan as he relaxed his grip. But Rufus was too far gone to answer. He continued to lie motionless on the floor, and Jonathan perceived to his great alarm blood streaming from his head and forming a pool on the floor. He soon succeeded in quieting the fears of the girls, who never afterwards repeated the projects which were thus unpleasantly interrupted, and his father coming home about that time, they stripped Rufus of his borrowed plumage and laid him in bed. His head was laid open to a frightful extent, and Jonathan mounted his horse and rode off in full gallop for a doctor. In good time, the doctor arrived, and after a close examination, declared the skull fractured, and that Rufus was, of course, in a very precarious situation. The delicate operation of trepanning was resorted to, and after the compression of the brain was removed, Rufus opened his eyes and uttered a faint groan. But the poor fellow remained in a dangerous state for several weeks, and was the victim of much suffering. His cousins, particularly Jane, who accused herself of being, in a great measure, the cause of his getting such a terrible thrashing, nursed him with much care and tenderness, and Rufus had a grateful heart and prided himself on his gallantry. The sequel may be imagined. Rufus whispered a tender tale in the ear of Jane. That young lady listened to it without displeasure, and finally consented to become his consort for life, upon condition that he would abandon all habits bordering on dissipation, quit the sea, stay on the land and cherish his wife, and eschew practical jokes henceforth and forever. Rufus Armstrong acceded to these conditions with alacrity. "As to practical jokes," he said, with an air of disgust, "I detest them from the bottom of my heart." In about 3 weeks from that time, the minister tied the knot, and Jane was heard to declare with a sly look that she believed there was some good in projects after all. Well, shipmates, that brings us to the end of this two-part story, Rufus Armstrong, Practical Jokes. And just, you know, once again, these stories in Ocean Adventures, edited by John Sleeper in the 1850s, are just awesome. I mean, the things these sailors get into, stealing a Chinaman's braid during a street riot in Batavia and bringing it back to Boston and having it made into this elaborate headdress and then getting chased by the police and the police grab it and it pulls it off your head. I mean, this is the crazy stuff that sailors get themselves into. And, you know, good stories, just good stories all around. Hey, well, thank you for joining us. And once again, I'm going to ask you to please make your way to the Apple iBooks or to Amazon and look me up, Malcolm Torres. I have several free stories on there. It would be great if you could just read those and post a review. I thank you very much. If you like them, there are several other stories on there for sale. If you're at liberty to purchase some of those stories, there's a few paperbacks available. I'd greatly appreciate it. Thank you so much. As always, follow me on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and Goodreads and LinkedIn. I look forward to connecting with you all online. And until our next story in a few days, fair winds and following seas, shipmates.